So welcome to the Gaelic Athlete Podcast. It's me, Conor O'Neill, and today I have a special guest in the form of David Nolan from Synapse Performance. How's things today, David?
Not too bad, Conor. Thank you once again for having me back on the show. I must say I do appreciate the very valuable work you're doing for GAA because there's a lot of misinformation, so you're putting out some real great content for GAA players around the country.
Well, likewise, we're all trying. Sort of speaking of that, I suppose yourself and myself both work with GAA players to a large extent. I know that you are also involved a lot with the rugby side of things, as well as the powerlifting and even body composition sports as well. So maybe give us a bit of background, just a quick background about yourself, an introduction to the people listening.
It's no problem. So from an academic background, I would have graduated from University of Limerick, Sport and Exercise Sciences, would have then went on and have, I'm heavily involved in research as well. So I would have been involved in nutrition research in UCD. In the next couple of months, I'm heading to a position in DCU. We're going to be doing some research around muscle physiology and also weight cutting strategies in MMA fighters. From an applied perspective, I would have been involved with GAA for several years, so in with Clare GAA for a while, some different club positions, currently head of strength and conditioning at Rugby Academy Ireland, and then also, as you said, of Synapse Performance, where I would work with people one-to-one, predominantly in field-based sports, working on, as you said, facets of their body composition. Competitively myself, I've played GAA, martial arts throughout the years, and also a competitive powerlifter. Taking a step back from that at the moment, I signed myself up for one of these Hell and Back yokes in the summer, so I don't know if that's going to be a regret of mine, but I'm getting back.
I'm in a similar boat. I've committed to a marathon now in May. And I'm in the same position of thinking, was I wise? But I have to do it anyway. Yeah.
Well, I can feel that I'm surprised after a year or two of just pure powerlifting, my aerobic capacity is coming back, so it's starting to get a bit easier. But yeah, so that's kind of what I generally do, and through Synapse, write about educational content then as well. So I suppose I describe myself as a coach, scientist, and educator. Sounds a bit arrogant, but I suppose that's the best description of what I try to do on a daily basis.
Yeah, and do a good job at it too. I would recommend, and I'll let you plug your stuff at the end, but for now, check out Synapse Performance. If you are into the nitty-gritty science stuff and you want it broken down into a concise manner that's actually applicable to you, that's where to go. So from your experience working with a lot of field sports athletes, we want to talk about today, and this is off the back of a podcast that you recorded for your podcast on speed and agility. I got a lot out of your podcast that you did, but I wanted to sort of break it down for the listeners to this podcast and maybe get some practical takeaways. So I think the first thing that I got out of hearing your podcast was this difference between straight up speed and agility. And a lot of people are trying to train speed, but aren't realizing the importance of the agility and what the differences is. So today I think we want to break down what is speed, what is agility, how to train for both, and what practical takeaways we can take away from it. So firstly, I would like maybe David, you to sort of give a bit of a definition of speed, and then maybe go into how we can actually train that and what are the principles behind it.
Yeah, that's no problem at all, because as you said, speed and agility are often used interchangeably, but they are two separate constructs. And I think firstly we have to realize when players come to us, or when a player says they want to get faster, what do they mean by that? Because a lot of coaches, if you come and they say, oh, I want to get faster, the coach said, Grant, I'll make you faster over your 10-meter sprint, your 20-meter sprint, your 30-meter sprint. If I can improve, get out the speed gates, improve the times there, you've become faster. But that's not what the player means when they say, I want to get faster. The player, as a GAA player, you have to firstly improve the performance on the pitch. So the player is saying, I want to be better getting to the ball first. I want to be better at tackling or whatever it may be. That's speed. So the straight up definition between speed is your ability to travel at high velocity, essentially. So within speed, that's just how quickly you can get from point A to point B in two kind of main avenues. So you have linear speed, how fast you can run in a straight line. So that is your, how quickly can you cover 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 meters. Then you have multi-directional speed. So that's, as it sounds, your ability to move fast at maximal velocity in varying directions. So if you run out, then cut 30 degrees for 10 meters, cut again at a right angle for 90 meters. So the basic drills that we see done day to day in on the pitch, they're kind of your speed drills, your ability just to move at maximal velocity. So if that is your goal and you want to improve your ability to get faster over 10, 20 or 30 meters in a straight line, a lot of time, and I don't know whether it's just a bias of S&C coaches assuming that gym work is the best thing to do, when we look both anecdotally and at the research, actually sprinting is the best way to get faster at sprinting. It kind of, and people, it's people don't really get that. People will ask, okay, which is better to get faster at sprinting, front squat or back squat? The question, their head is already in the gym. Where if I said to someone, which is better to get, and people will even ask, which will improve my speed more, squatting heavier or running on the pitch more? And I'm like, well, which do you think can improve your squat more, squatting in the gym or running on the pitch? It's we have this kind of dichotomy where one way people's head seems to be confused, but if you ask the reverse, people will know the answer straight away. So that actually going out onto the pitch and practicing running fast is the best way to improve your sprint ability. And that is the greatest transfer. And what's funny enough, even any players listening, ask yourself, how often do I actually practice running as fast as I possibly can? Because most time in team training, you won't do it. Because if you're doing, say, conditioning sprints, which is mainly what seems to be done in GA training, you know you have 10, 20 more sprints coming with 10 seconds break. So you're in a fatigue state or you're anticipating a lot more work. So you pull your runs a bit short. Yes, you're putting an effort, but you may not be running 100%. So a lot of times GA players come to me wanting to get faster. And then when I look at their training, they don't actually practice sprinting. So to practice sprinting properly, you should be in a fresh state. If you're fatigued, you cannot generate maximal velocity. It's just the way it is. So you should be in a fresh state, do a nice warm-up, and then do 10 seconds all out, or not 10 seconds, 10 meters all out sprint, and really focus on moving as fast as you possibly can. A lot of guys that pull hamstrings in matches, it's when they get up to that max velocity that they're not exposed to on a regular basis. So that's what you need to do, and then take long breaks between your sprints. You know, let the creatine phosphate system, let it all recharge, get fully replenished, and then sprint again. And if you look at even professional sprinters, they don't do that many sprints in a session. It's quite taxing. So even if you're doing 3 10-meter sprints, 3 20-meter sprints, and 3 30-meter sprints, if you do that 2 to 3 times a week, you're getting a lot of high velocity exposure there. So that's actually protective against the hamstring injuries to a certain degree. And then also it just allows you to actually practice running as fast as you possibly can. And that's when guys will start to notice their mechanics break down then as well. So first and foremost, you want to increase your linear speed is actually practice sprinting. So once you're doing that, then you got to break down the sprint itself. Do you understand mechanics? Are you, a lot of guys seem to be, when they sprint, very tense in the shoulders and arms, where they need speed is not, if you are very tense, you can't move that quickly. So they need to learn to loosen up. Also the foot mechanics, there's a big difference between your acceleration sprinting and then when you actually get the speed up. So acceleration phase is very piston-like. The legs are just pumping. And then once you get past that 20, 30, 40 meters into your top end speed, the run becomes more cyclic. Now, I tend to not worry too much about that because rarely guys in GA match are going to hit 20 to 30 meters of top end speed that often. It's that acceleration phase, that first 5, 10, 15 meters. That's where it's made. Because we'll talk about agility in a while. Generally in GA, once we get to that top end speed, we usually slow down a bit and then go again. It's not all just accelerating the whole way. So looking at your mechanics, and this could be as simple as putting a video camera to the side of you when you run and in front of you, and just look at yourself and get someone to understand what your biomechanics should look like. And then you can do some varying drills. If you Google sprint drills, you'll come up with some things, or it's not too bad. So that'd be the next thing. Look at your mechanics, see how you're going there. And that can even be protective against injury then as well, because a lot of guys that maybe stretch out a bit too much too forward in their sprinting tend to get some hamstring strains happening there at the proximal end of the hamstring. So they'll be the first two. You need to practice sprinting and you need to work on your mechanics. Mm-hmm. Once that's in line, and this is something that is actually quite, I won't say easy because that's a bit of a simplification, but body composition is a big thing. Mm-hmm. Guys, most GAA players will benefit from just being a bit leaner. Mm-hmm. And that's simple as you know yourself, when you stand in a inter-county dressing room, you don't see anyone carrying weight. That's, and we have research shown that the difference between elite and sub-elite players, body composition is a big factor in that. Elite players are just that generally leaner, and you don't see any top-level player that's not lean. Now, our perception of what lean means has been completely bastardized by social media and this. Like, they're not bodybuilders. There shouldn't be veins popping and ripped to shreds with paper thin skin, but you shouldn't be carrying excess body fat. You should be quite lean and athletic, and that will make a big difference. Like, if anyone wants to go out and throw a 5 kilo weight vest on and try sprint around the pitch, you'll see how quickly you become fatigued. Where if you just take that off, it's the same thing. Like, fat adipose really doesn't do a whole lot in terms of, it just sits there. It has endocrine functions and it is negative on health, all right, and mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. But excess body fat, really, from an athletic perspective, as a GA player, is not of any benefit whatsoever. So they're the three main things there. You're actually sprinting, your mechanics, your body composition. And then also what you'll be doing along and has other things is your physical capacity. So your actual strength, power, and plyometrics. Now, I think guys invest too much time as a whole in this. I'm an S&C coach, and I think GA players spend too much time with S&C in certain conditions. As a GA player, I don't see much merit. If you can do 3 solid sessions a week, push it to 4 if you have a kind of a very, what should I say, a luxury lifestyle where you have a lot of time on your hands. Mm-hmm. But 3 solid sessions or 4 shorter sessions a week is more than sufficient to build up the physical capacities for a GA player. A lot of guys who are spending 5-6 days a week in the gym as a GA player would be better off replacing 1 or 2 of those extra gym sessions with extra skill work on the pitch, mm-hmm. Be it tackling or actually working on their mechanics and their sprinting. But in terms of your gym work, you want to get a good base of strength, obviously, at the start. So strength will underpin power. So, but a lot of guys get invested too much in this. As a GA player, once you get your say your lower body strength, your back squat or your trap bar deadlift, once you're up around 1.5, 1.6 times body weight, that's a decent enough standard. Like, we see when you look at the correlative stuff, you see up to about 2 times body weight back squat, and it's kind of correlation with speed. Not all that strong or a strong of a correlation. So just getting stronger alone doesn't always make you faster, or the strongest guys aren't always the fastest. But generally, you'll see an improvement in speed up to about 2 times body weight squat, and then it kind of tapers off after that. But if we think from a practical perspective, most GAA players, once they follow a decent program, they'll get to about 1.5 body weight squat relatively easily in a short space of time, say within a year or a year and a half. But to push from 1.5 to 2 times body weight squat, that takes a lot of time of dedicated work. And it's your investment in terms of the amount of fatigue you have to build up, the amount of work you have to put into your squat just to make that extra strength gain. I don't see it as beneficial as a GAA player. So once your strength is up around there, yeah, maintain it, look to improve it, but don't get totally bogged down in, I have to get stronger in the back squat. That's not what's going to make you a better player at that stage. So once you have a decent level of strength underpinning, and that's through a full range of motion and getting your hamstrings and hips and quads and everything strength through a full range of motion, most guys tend to leave it there. But what we see is strength is specific in its transfer. So if we are looking for high degrees of force in high velocity movements, which is what sprinting on a pitch is, then we have to do high velocity movements with our strength work. And a lot of guys go too heavy in the gym for what they need to do. So things like trap bar jumps, things like I like quarter squat where you bring the bar down, rest it on the safety pins in about quarter squat position and explode up into a jump. If guys are proficient, hang high pulls, these kind of things, I don't tend to program them because they're just too complex for most guys. But things and like landmine push presses, all these kind of things, things to get the hip joint moving from that angle that you're going to be pushing from in that sprint position at high velocities. And why guys tend to shy away from it, and even S&C coaches, is because it's difficult to measure. Unless you have a tendo unit that is a bit of pricey kit or something, like if someone puts 5 kgs on their back squat, it's very easy to see that they've gone up 5 kgs. Where if someone, if I put 30 kg on a trap bar or trap bar alone and get someone jumping, and I can't look at them and say, yeah, that was 0.22 meters a second, where the other one was 0.25 last week. You have to measure that quite, so it takes more investment. But even without measuring it accurately, I just include it. Get guys moving fast, and you need to be doing that. And guys, as GA players, it feels easy to them. It's not hugely fatiguing in the traditional sense. You know, guys won't have to grind through it. Guys will feel fresh after doing the sets. The session won't feel like being that taxing, but it's important work that they need to do. Mm-hmm. And then in addition to that, then you start to add in your plyometric stuff, looking at keeping your tendon stiffness in the ankle. So your drop jumps, your depth jumps, that kind of thing. Just even just counterweight, counter movement jumps on the spot, just dipping and jumping as high as you can. Lateral jumps, very important to introduce different force vectors and different directions of force in terms of just for the knee tendons, ligaments, and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So in terms of straight linear speed, they're the main things if that's what you want to improve. Yeah. Go out, number one is actually sprint. I then say body composition and your mechanics, get a bit leaner, work on your mechanics, and then work on your physical capacities in the gym. And more than likely, that's the hierarchy I would go. The gym work in terms of improving that straight linear speed probably doesn't go as high as most people think it would on the order of importance.
Very good. I think it's very interesting because we're talking about is isolating the speed work as opposed to what a lot of people tend to do is to try and lump the speed work in with their fitness work or the cardio work sort of. So they're, you know, they're sprinting, resting for, as you said, maybe 30 seconds and they're still fatigued going into the next sprint. But I think it's important that you are doing some isolated speed work in that capacity. And I suppose that can be hard to do within a team setting, but we'll maybe get into a few recommendations at the end towards what you can do as an individual. And I noticed there, David, you didn't mention anything about glute activation. I see it online with you know, certain prominent names, and they're asked, you know, how do I improve my speed? And the first thing they go to is not sprinting, it's not getting stronger, it's not getting leaner, it's glute activation. And it's become a bit of a meme from my point of view, anyway, that people see. What's the story with that?
You see, I have a course coming out very soon that has the secret to glute activation, so I'll be plugging that in a while, so I'll sell that to people. Now it's one of my gripes, and like that, and when we think it's just basic muscle physiology and biomechanics, it does not make sense. The idea, people are like, oh, your glutes aren't firing. First of all, what the fuck does firing mean? I don't know whether they mean contracting, if that's it, or because if you bring your leg through the sprinting range of motion, your glutes are contracting. They have to be in order to do that. Your glutes aren't activated. Again, what does that mean to activate a muscle? Activate's just become a fancy word for warm-up. So yeah, maybe no harm warming up your glutes. Mm-hmm. Like any decent GA warm-up is probably going to have a few hip bridges in it, or single leg hip bridge or that kind of stuff. Yeah. Or even like these kind of high knee skipping drills, they're going to get the glutes warmed, a few squat jumps. So the warm and up problem won't be an issue. The idea that just getting your glutes to fire or activate is ludicrous by itself. Like your glutes are will be working, will be activated. Where probably it is applicable is just strengthening your glutes, which is probably not a bad idea in terms of people get obsessed thinking the glutes are the most important muscle in sprinting, which they play a big role, but arguably the hamstrings could even be seen as more important in terms of developing maximal velocity. So I think it's important to not get caught up in, and it's a quick fix, isn't it? It's a quick fix if you tell someone how to get faster, or you just need to do these two or three exercises before a session that'll get your glutes firing, which it's absolute bullshit, to be honest.
And maybe the placebo kicks in and they do feel the benefit, and then, well, you're sort of caught in a conundrum of, is it, you know, it's obviously not a scientifically sort of advocated solution, but people get into the way of doing them before every session and they feel then that they can't give it up. So
exactly, they become dependent on it. Yeah. So, but any good S&C program that's going to be looking to improve your ability to sprint on a pitch, it's going to have elements that's going to strengthen your glutes. It's going to have squat movements. It's going to have a hip hinge movement, and it's probably going to have some sort of hip thrusting movement, all of which is going to lead to strengthening the glutes. Probably what some work maybe guys don't do is some glute medius work could be incorporated. So some kind of groin work and glute medius is probably often mitigated. So some abduction exercise and some adduction exercises would be good to add in most cases. But a lot of times you'll see it strengthened if you're doing side lunges, if you're doing lateral jumps, these kind of things, you're hitting those muscles then as well. Yeah. So yeah, overall, I think that the term glute activation is just a buzzword that's easy to throw out that no one really understands when they're saying it. It shows, if I hear someone saying you just need to get to activate your glutes or get your glutes firing, it shows to me that they have a clear lack of understanding of human physiology or strength and conditioning.
Very good. So right, so we've covered speed there on its own. But the interesting thing that I took from your podcast was the difference between speed and agility. So what are the differences, and how would you define agility?
See, this is where we really get down the rabbit hole and it gets really interesting and a bit abstract, because I would have been like most, like everyone would have started off lumping speed and agility, they're all the one thing. And then kind of by getting exposed to certain people, Lauren Landau and Professor Ian Jeffries, kind of started to make me think and reevaluate a bit more about it. So essentially, speed is, as I said, that's your ability to move fast, either linear speed or multi-directional speed. So that's your how quickly you can move from point A to point B or in several different planes of movement. Agility, however, that's a completely different construct. And originally, the original definitions of agility would have been your ability to move explosively or change direction explosively. So that's what most people think of agility, your ability to hit a cone and cut in a different direction. But that doesn't really cut what agility is. Where Shepherd and Young then moved on research 2011, and I'm paraphrasing now, they described agility as a whole body movement in response to a stimulus. And this is starting to move the paradigm along where, okay, we start to see that there's a bit more than just your ability to change direction fast. You're doing that in anticipation of something or reacting to something. So as a player, you don't just cut for the sake of it. You cut because there's a player coming, either they're trying to get by you, you're trying to get by them. That's why you change direction. So you're reacting to their movement and going. And then Ian Jeffries would have developed that and came on even further. And he would have described it as a context-specific movement. So he said agility was a context-specific movement. So that means agility isn't the same across the spectrum. Like agility training for a tennis player and for a GA player are different because the context is different. And it's where the athlete maximizes athletic performance. So that is in the second important, maximize sports performance. So your agility should lead to an improvement in the sports performance. And it's via the application, now I'm just trying to think, via the application of appropriate velocities. So sport-specific movements in appropriate velocities. And note that it's not maximal velocities, it's appropriate or optimal velocity, precision and control, in response to or an anticipation of key perceptual stimuli. Now, that all sounds a bit up in the air. So basically what it means is agility is your ability to react appropriately and move appropriately in response to or in anticipation of a stimulus coming from the game. So the movement of a player, the movement of a ball. And what's important is it's your response or you're responding with the appropriate skill, control and optimal velocity required. So where most agility drills, you think of all the ones we've ever done, it's you run, say you have five cones and you have to get between them all. You run like a headless chicken to all of them as fast as you can, as fast as you can, and you come back and everything, you're backpedaling as fast as you can, you're moving. In the game, we don't do that. What do we do in the game? If we think, and this is why the problem with agility as it went forward, we were, just had these, we knew what agility was or what we thought it was, this ability to move fast in different directions. And so we built our drills around that. But we should reverse engineer that. We should look at the game first, what are the movements of the game, and then build our drills from that. So if we think about in a game setting, we don't just, like if I have a player coming at me, if I'm wing back and my man is coming at me, I don't just run as fast as I can to him and then when he's going by me, side shuffle as fast as I can and then backpedal. Mm-hmm. I will get into that kind of athletic position, turn my hips a little bit, shuffle slowly, slowly, and then attack. And then if you are with the ball, say if you're running for a man, if you are full forward running at the full back and you're going to sidestep him, you don't sprint as hard as you can at him and cut as hard as you can and go around him. If you watch players what to do, yes, they'll sprint as hard as they can. And then when they're a couple of meters short of their man, they slow down slightly, feint, cut, and then go. So it's that ability to vary your velocity and vary that with your movements. So that's where agility comes in. So agility is your ability to react well and move appropriately in response to that. So when we're trying to think of how we train agility, and that's the problem, when you're talking about precision and control, like your multi-directional speed, most players can do that well and get good at that. Agility is your ability to perceive and react appropriately under pressure. Mm. And that's what differentiates great players from poor players, because our movement patterns and skills in sport, they tend to break down mainly under two conditions. The most often one we see is fatigue. Guys get fatigue and their movements get sloppy, their skills get sloppy. And the second is pressure. You put guys under pressure and their passes go astray, their tackles go astray. Just guys cannot do well under pressure. Where the great players, they do well under pressure. They make the right decision. And that's the big thing with agility. You have to make a decision. You have to react to your situation, your environment, and make an appropriate decision. And the most agile players are the ones that make the most appropriate decision under pressure the whole time. They decide to go to the man when they should. They decide to feint when they should, or they read the feint much better. Their decision-making and perception is much better. So that's kind of, I know it's confusing for people to think about that, but that's the main difference between speed. Your speed is your ability to move very fast in different directions. Agility is a much more profound construct. Your ability to perceive your environment, react appropriately, and make the proper decision, appropriate decision. And then once that decision is made, your body, you do a whole body movement with the appropriate skill and control.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, you can sort of draw a similarity to, you know, your strength training in the gym, but you're not strength training to get better at, say, the bench press. You're strength training so that when you go onto the pitch, you know, you're stronger in the tackle, for example. So it's like you take what you're doing with your strength in the gym and you bring that onto the pitch in a completely different format, where you're not, you know, straight up bench pressing a person off the ball. So it's sort of similar, where you're training your speed in an isolated capacity. And then you need to practice how you bring that into the game.
Yeah. And I suppose the best analogy, like even people hear that and they're like, that can't be true. And the reason why people are so resistant to it's hard to measure. Like with speed, you can measure 10, 20, 30 meters. You can do with the old, say the Illinois agility test, you can measure. You have a nice finite thing. They did it in 5 seconds last month. They can do it in 4.5 seconds this time. Mm-hmm. They're more agile, which is not great. It's like, if they get quicker at that test, can we say they are more agile on the pitch or they perform better on the pitch? And we can't actually do that. It all comes back down to the pitch performance, where with this stuff, you can't really measure accurately if someone is being more precise and controlled under pressure. You know, anecdotally, where the player starts to come to you and says, yeah, I find that guys aren't getting by me is easier anymore. Mm-hmm. I find I'm reading the play better that I get to the ball first, or I'm able to beat my man to the ball first because I can read the space much better. And we see this in practice where I think we've all faced it where there's guys that are mediocre in the tests, as in we do a 10, 20, 30 meter test. They're not great. They're middle of the pack. They're mediocre. We do an agility test where we time them. They're mediocre. Yet in the game, these guys are cleaning up. Mm-hmm. So on paper, they're not the fastest. They're not the strongest. But Jesus, on the pitch, no one can really keep with them.
So sometimes your best players are like that.
Yeah. All the fitness tests, they're not great. They're not fast. They're not strong. Mm-hmm. But on the pitch, they will absolutely annihilate anyone that marks them. They leave them for dust. And that's because they have a greater ability to read, perceive their environment, and make appropriate decisions. In elite soccer, the example Ian Jeffrey uses is Lionel Messi, probably regarded as the greatest player in the world. Put him in the gym. Is he the strongest on that team? Probably not. Put him in a straight sprint, probably not the strongest either or fastest. And any of these agility tests, probably not the fastest in the agility tests. But as a player, his ability to perceive, make appropriate decisions and react accordingly is what makes him the best. So that's why a lot of time we need to kind of get away from this idea that everything needs to be just pure data where, okay, like as a manager, are we making, or as an S&C coach, is our job to make our players better at performing their sport or to make them better at performing tests, which we can give ourselves a pat on the back then, like, oh, I've made my players faster by 0.2 of a second on average across this test, yet they're getting hockeyed every day on the pitch. So, you know, and that's where you see the S&C coach, well, I've done my job, you know what I mean? It's the manager's fault, where you got to get out of that kind of that mindset. Yeah. And I suppose that's the problem where we see the training then going, where most guys who think they're training agility with players are actually training multi-directional speed. If I tell you, you run to that cone, then you cut that way, and then you go that way, that's all pre-rehearsed. There's no decision-making element. There's no reactive element. That's multi-directional speed. And that's fine to train if you're looking to improve multi-directional speed, or you're looking to get them to work on their cutting mechanics, you're looking to expose them to cutting movements, that you want to do that for a conditioning reason or a preventative reason for injury. But if you think doing that and you're thinking you're training agility, you're wrong. Your agility drills should have some degree of reaction and decision-making element in my deal. They all don't have to be like that. Some of them might be reaction only. Some of them might be decision-making only. But a great agility drill will have players moving with sport-specific movements in multi-directions with a reaction to sport-specific stimuli and decision-making element. And that's a simple one where I say sport-specific stimuli. In a game, we react to two main things. We react to visual stimuli, the movement of our player, of our man we're marking, or the ball, movement of other players around. And also, well, I suppose kinesthetic, you'd call it. If any good marker is probably going to have their hand on their man, and you feel them actually going or moving. So they're the two main reactions we have in GA. Yet all agility drills start with a whistle or a verbal cue. Mm-hmm. So if you can find a way to kind of incorporate appropriate visual or kinesthetic cues into your agility drills, that's even bringing it up a different level.
Yeah, very good. I think it'll be very important for guys to listen to this to take away that there are the two separate things, so that they should be training their speed and they should also be doing different things to train their agility, whether that is, you know, setting up a scenario where you're getting used to reacting to the movement of your marker, or getting used to the movement of, or your reaction to a stimulus like a ball moving a certain direction, or a player or someone pointing a certain direction, or something along those lines.
Some of the greatest agility drills are one-on-one tackling drills. Uh-huh. You put a guy in a tunnel, you think of it, a guy is moving at you, so you have to move in several different directions. Your hips and feet have to move quite rapidly, rapid whole body movements. He's coming at you, you have to react to his movements, and then you have to make the appropriate decision. Do you tackle, do you step off, do you give space? That's a great agility drill, where most people don't even view that as an agility drill. They just view it as tackling or conditioning, where agility is not just running between cones. That is a great agility drill. And where you'll see guys get caught out there is not adopting a decent stance. Like, the first yard in the sprint, especially in a GA match, the way you stand and the way you hold yourself can have a huge impact, and the difference between you getting that first half second, that first half yard. Where how many times have you seen guys get turned or put under hole because they're standing square to their man, feet, two mm-hmm. feet parallel, straight forward, and try put an arm to stop him. Yeah. Where, you know, if you get turn that hips to him in that bit more of a leg stance, where now you're in a position, you're more balanced, where you can push off either foot. Those little things, those kind of tackling drills, you do them enough, guys will self-coach. If you have a guy that stands square to his man every time and he keeps getting put on his hole, eventually he's going to kind of realize himself that, oh, if I turn slightly this way and set up this way, I'm better able to react and put in a tackle. So those kind of things where you don't need to overcoach. Some of these drills will just make players better at the skills of the game by themselves.
Yeah. So no need for agility ladders then?
They're an interesting one where I generally don't use them. And in most cases, I don't see much merit for them because it's such an unnatural movement pattern. And also this kind of fast feet, where we don't move like that on a pitch. Like you think of, and this is why we need to get away from building our drills up to the game, where we need to look at the game and build our drills from that. If we think of, okay, so a guy is marking a player and his player goes, okay, what position does the marker stand in at the start? Grand. They've probably even space, shoulder width stance, evenly space, even the way it distribute. Their player runs. Okay. Now, when the marker goes to follow their player, are they going to go into these rapid little short steps where their feet are 6 inches across, or is their first step probably a long stride? And it's more than likely probably a long stride. It's a power stride off, and then they go and go from there. So now when we look at the ladder, we're like, okay, if our ladder is to improve agility, that ability for that man to move quickly and react, does the ladder drill reflect what we're doing on the pitch? And it doesn't. And what coaching can you do with a ladder drill where it's fast feet the whole way up? You can tell them, get faster. That's your only cue pretty much to your athletes. Like, that was good, now do it faster. And if I get a player in a ladder drill, if I make them twice as fast over the space of a month across that ladder drill, does it make them better on the pitch? I don't know. I don't think so. Probably not. If you're using it just, if your rationale is you want to work on ankle tendon stiffness, stuff like this, that's fine. But if you're doing that to make them faster as a sprinter, you're wasting time and fatigue there. And also, the ladder is the exact same width for every player. Yeah. And you have players that are 6'4", and you have guys like me, 5'10", at a stretch, 5'10", I should say. And what am I saying? I'm 5'8". I don't know why I said 5'10". I've probably just been lying that much over the years. When, you know, where I do it, it's a totally different biomechanics. And the same with hurdles. Guys going over these hurdles the same way. And like this, these laterally going over hurdles, bring the knee up, because that's to improve your ability to sprint laterally or push off laterally. Where again, is the step when we first make that sprint, is it a low step or a high step? It's a low step. The knee goes out low and drives from that position. Mm-hmm. So again, just have a look at itself. It's always good as a coach to audit why we do things. Because a lot of time, and I know I still probably do stuff where I do it because that's the way I've seen someone do it, and someone taught me to do it that way, and that's just the way we do it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you just question, why do I do this? What's my rationale here? Is this achieving the goal I want to achieve on the pitch? Mm-hmm. And a lot of time it isn't. Like, ladders, yeah, they have their place potentially. I just not a great fan of them. I think time can be better spent in other areas.
100%. I'm conscious of time here, David, so we probably maybe have a couple of minutes left, but I wanted to give some like just quick practical takeaways from all this that someone who, you know, a lot of the mostly players listening to this, so they don't have control over what the team does in the training session, but they do have control of, say, their gym work. They have control of, you know, days that they're not training with the team. They have control of maybe that they could show up a bit earlier to training and do their own stuff. You know, what can they, maybe three things that they could bring in to maximize that speed and agility?
I suppose the biggest things, so generally when I work with players, we try to get the low-hanging fruit first. So the things that when we implement them, we'll see the results quickest. Body composition is probably a big one. Mm-hmm. For most players that are struggling with their speed, just need to get leaner. The need to go hire a guy like you, take care of their nutrition. But yeah, just getting a few kilos leaner generally will make a big impact to your speed. On top of that, you're just practice your sprinting. Rock up 10-15 minutes early to training, or like sprint sessions as themselves shouldn't be too long if it's a pure speed session. So you could do it in 20 minutes on your days off. Just warm up and just start off with 3 10-meter sprints with a minute or two rest between 3 20-meter sprints and 3 30-meter sprints. Go home after that. They're very taxing on the hamstrings particularly. So if you go overboard on your, if you haven't done maximal sprinting work where you're trying to run as fast as possible, and that's the thing, really push yourself. Most guys don't ever actually get to top end speed. Push yourself that you cannot move any faster. If you're doing that and you haven't done it before, start off very gradually, just a handful of sprints and build it up over time. Do a handful of sprints.
Just to jump in, David, because I know you made the point sort of earlier, but these runs that you're doing are not runs that you're building up any acidosis in the muscles or anything. It's stuff that's not really fatiguing in that type of way.
It's just straight as fast as you can, and then walk back and wait a minute, deep breath, and then be fully recovered before the next one. They're not fatiguing in traditional sense. You shouldn't be breathing heavy. It's not a conditioning drill. It's more, think of it as a technique drill than anything else. But it can be quite taxed on the hamstring. So if you're going from not doing it at all to doing 3 sessions a week, you're going to end up probably with a hamstring strain just from inappropriate loading. But what the cool thing is, if you get good at this and expose yourself, we see research that those that are exposed to good levels of high velocity sprints actually has a protective mechanism on the hamstring that they seem to sustain less hamstring strains. So that's good from that perspective. So there are two things, body composition and your sprinting. And within those sprinting drills, when you're practicing, you should be practicing your mechanics, good arm drive, good leg drive, nice and relaxed. And then in terms of your physical capacity for any of your gym work, like a lot of guys get obsessed with doing arms and that kind of stuff, get a decent level of strength and mobility through the lower body. Don't get obsessed with being super, super flexible. If you can do a decent range body or back squat or goblet squat, if you're doing those through a good range of motion, same good hip hinge, be an RDL, dumbbell or straight bar, and you can do decent levels of hip thrusts, those type of things. Build your program around those kind of things, a squat movement, a hip hinge movement, and a hip thrust movement, and they'll be quite good. And then also working at the higher velocities then as well. A lot of guys only do the heavy stuff where you need to work at a high velocity. So your jumping movements, doing trap bar jumps, body weight jumps, lateral jumps. And then also I would put in high velocity eccentrics. Now these, I'd get a strength coach to actually teach you these because a lot of guys can go wrong with this. But your ability to eccentrically control, especially on the hamstrings. So things like Nordic falls, where you have a resistance band, you're in a Nordic curl position, and you allow yourself to drop down, but stop yourself quarter the way, drop, stop yourself halfway, and the end ranges requires a good bit of strength to be able to do them in the first place. But once you get good at them, can be quite a good degree of transfer over to sprinting, and also protective on the hamstring. The type of things you'd start off to do is split squat drops. So get yourself into a lunge position where you're standing at the top position, and then drop down into the low position of a lunge or split squat and control it. Those type of velocity, high velocity eccentric drops can be quite good in terms of transfer then as well. So if your program is like that, building strength through your squat and hip hinging and hip thrusting, and then putting in high velocity movements with your jumping in different directions, and then also a few drop kind of stuff with your plyometric drops, and then some lunge drops just for eccentric control, that's a pretty solid S&C program there. Then just throw in some of your upper body power and strength work again, and you have a fairly solid program there. So they're probably the big three takeaways. Sort out your body composition, practice sprinting, and then have a decent auditor S&C program to see that it's effectively hitting the qualities that you want to hit.
Perfect. No, I think that's great practical implications for people listening to the takeaway. just to sort of finish up, do tag myself and David on Instagram if you're listening here. Just screenshot wherever you're listening to and stick it up, tag us both in. And David, I wanted to give you a chance to let people know where to go to maybe find out more about what you're up to.
That's perfect. Everything can be found on the website, so www.synapseperformance.ie. You can find me then on Instagram at synapseperformance. Or on Facebook, David Nolan, if you put it in there, you'll find me. Again, I know some of the things that I discussed say were a bit kind of abstract, and I tend to ramble a bit when I get into these kind of rabbit holes. So if there's anything that people want clarification on, reach out to me over social medias, or my email is david@synapseperformance.ie. And there at the website, you'll find all our services in terms of coaching, education, or seminars that we give to clubs and coaches. So anything there, just get in touch and I'll get back to you.
Thanks very much, David. Just want to say thanks for everybody for listening, and thanks again to David for taking time out of his busy schedule to bless us with some knowledge. So thanks very much, David.
Thanks, Connor. It was a pleasure.